So today I'd like to first begin by explaining why we chose this particular theme and topic for the third CIDR summer program, and then remind you of some of the properties of the large yet still enigmatic boundary layers that exist deep within the Earth. So the theme of this year's summer program, Boundary Layers in Earth, a Multidisciplinary View, was actually chosen to recognize and celebrate the 100th anniversary of the publication of the first paper introducing the concept of the boundary layer and the physics and mathematics that govern the properties of boundary layers. And so this is where we're going to begin, and then I'll try and make a connection between the concepts introduced in this very first paper and some of the ways in which we think about boundary layers within the Earth. In 1904, Ludwig Prandtl gave a talk at the Third International Mathematics Congress called On the Motion of Fluids with Very Little Friction. He published a paper with the same title the following year in the proceedings of this Congress. And it's in this paper that he introduced the concept of the boundary layer and the mathematics and physics that govern the behavior and properties of boundary layers. A little bit about Prandtl. Let's see, in 1904, he was a 28-year-old professor at Hanover. He got his PhD in solid mechanics, where he studied the unstable equilibria of elastic materials undergoing both distortion and rotation. He then worked as a professional engineer, where he was exposed to fluid mechanics. He was assigned the task of designing an apparatus to suck up wood shavings generated by a lathe. In 1901, I guess he was 25, he became a professor at Hanover, and in 1904 moved to Göttingen. So a bit of background so you can appreciate the importance of what Prandtl was about to do. And obviously this history I'm giving you is greatly abbreviated and necessarily oversimplified. And I'm going to begin with Euler, who envisaged a fluid as consisting of little tiny elements that interact with each other. And I guess this is what we would now call the continuum approximation. And he assumed that Newton's second law, force equals mass times acceleration, applies to each one of these little fluid elements. With this assumption, then, he could write down an equation that describes conservation of mass and conservation of momentum for spatially varying fields, in particular the velocity u and the pressure p. And rho here is the density. The second equation is simply a statement of force equals mass times acceleration, Newton's second law. This first term describes the change of velocity in a moving reference frame, so it's the mass times acceleration. The second term is the force. And so now we have a set of coupled partial differential equations that should describe fluid flow. And Euler showed that these equations describe what was well known about hydrostatics and could explain many ideas and laws established earlier that century, for example, Bernoulli's famous law. But these laws couldn't explain everything. They couldn't explain, for example, what was known as D'Alembert's paradox, the apparent absence of resistance to motion of symmetric objects in moving through a fluid. To quote D'Alembert himself, "Thus I do not see, I admit, how one can satisfactorily explain by theory the resistance of fluids. On the contrary, it seems to me that theory developed in all possible rigor," so it's a compliment to Euler here, "gives at least in several cases a strictly vanishing resistance, a singular paradox which I leave to future geometers for elucidation." And you, just like future geometers, know that fluids do dissipate energy within them. There is resistance to motion, internal friction, through a property called viscosity. And real fluids do have viscosity. Claude-Louis Navier in 1822 and a mathematician at Cambridge, George Stokes in 1845, accounted for the effects of viscosity, and the famous equations called the Navier-Stokes equations account for viscosity and bear their name. In passing, I will note that two other people independently also derived these equations, Poisson in 1829 and Saint-Venant 1837. Now, even though we have viscosity here, these are coupled nonlinear partial differential equations, which means that there's no general analytical solution for these equations. And this was vexing at the time because people did want to, for example, calculate the resistance to motion through fluids. And the kinds of fluids most people are familiar with, air and water, have very low viscosities. So you don't expect the viscosity to play a dominant role in governing the flow. Yet if you don't account for viscosity, there are no shear stresses in a fluid, that is, stresses tangential to a surface, and you might expect that these would play an important role in providing resistance to motion. So here's what Prandtl did. He hypothesized that the simplest and most direct effect of viscosity is that the fluid adheres or sticks to a solid surface. There's then a thin region called the boundary layer, this region shown in blue, in which the fluid goes from being at rest next to the solid surface to reaching the free stream velocity at some distance away from the solid surface. And it's in this thin region where velocity gradients are the largest. So in sum, we have two different regions in these flows, an area way out here where viscosity doesn't matter, it's well described by Euler's equation, and a thin region where viscosity does matter. Adam, who will be talking, I'm going to quote Prandtl himself first. Very satisfactory explanation for the physical processes in the boundary layer between a fluid and solid bound body could be obtained by the hypothesis of adhesion of the fluid to the walls. That is, the hypothesis of zero relative velocity between the fluid and the wall. If the viscosity is very small and the fluid path along the wall not too long, the fluid velocity ought to resume its normal value at a very short distance from the wall. In the thin transition layer, however, the sharp changes of velocity, even with a small coefficient of friction, produce marked results. I haven't read the original paper, it's in German, but apparently he used the expression transition layer 9 times and the word boundary layer just once. So Adam, who's talking next, encouraged me not to show any equations. But what Prandtl did is so beautiful. Of course, I have to at least talk you through the concept behind what he did. And Bruce Buffett on Wednesday is going to introduce thermal boundary layers and go through a similar type of analysis, but fortunately for a slightly simpler problem. So what's written down here are two equations for flow in the boundary layer. Conservation of mass, ux is velocity in the horizontal direction, uy is velocity in the vertical direction. And here's the problem Prandtl set up. You have a uniform flow on the left with velocity u approaching a solid surface and flowing over that solid surface. And because of the effects of friction, then, our boundary layer develops. The second equation describes the flow in this boundary layer. We've dropped the time derivative of velocity because it's a steady problem. And the only other term that's dropped is the change in horizontal velocity with respect to vertical position, because we're assuming the vertical length scales are so much smaller than the horizontal length scales. There's one other equation that's lost, the conservation of momentum equation for the vertical direction. It reduces to the change in pressure with respect to vertical position is zero. That is, the pressure with respect to depth in the boundary layer is uniform. Okay, so we have a pair of coupled partial differential equations. If you look at this picture, there's no obvious length scale imposed by the geometry. The only real length scale you see here is the thickness of the boundary layer. We can estimate how thick it is by balancing inertial forces on the left-hand side with viscous forces on the right-hand side. Inertial forces, the left-hand side term, scale like the velocity squared divided by the horizontal position or scale. This expression on the left-hand side. Right-hand side are viscous stresses, kinematic viscosity times velocity over this boundary layer thickness. So this allows us to relate the boundary layer thickness delta to properties of the flow. And I've rewritten this equation on the top. Boundary layer thickness should scale like the square root of position downstream and depend on the velocity and the kinematic viscosity. We're now going to hypothesize that the form of the velocity variations within this boundary layer is self-similar. It simply scales with height normalized relative to the thickness of the boundary layer. So now we have an explicit relationship between vertical position, horizontal position x, the viscosity of the fluid, and the velocity. We'll then hypothesize, in fact, that this is what the form of the solution looks like. That is, the horizontal velocity is simply a function of this new variable we call eta up here. Often eta, in fact, is termed a similarity variable. With this hypothesis, we go back to our original coupled partial differential equation, substitute this expression into them, and lo and behold, you end up with a single ordinary differential equation written down here for this new function f. And because it's an ordinary differential equation, we can now solve it rather than our coupled partial differential equation. Regrettably, it's nonlinear. And so what Prandtl did is he solved this equation, and he found the form of the velocity distribution in the boundary layer. You can calculate the stresses on the solid surface. They scale like viscosity times velocity gradient. So they scale like the velocity, for example, to the 3/2 power. If you integrate over the length of a plate, it scales like the length of the plate to 1/2 power. So we've resolved this D'Alembert's paradox. Because of friction or viscosity in the thin boundary layer, there is resistance to motion. So in sum, again, there are two different regions. There's a thin boundary layer where viscosity matters. Out here, viscosity doesn't matter. These two layers, of course, interact with each other. In fact, the outer layer can be, the flow out here, can be obtained by solving Euler's equation. And this provides the boundary conditions for the flow and dynamics within the boundary layer. That is, the outer region controls the dynamics of the boundary layer. The boundary layer has virtually no influence on the surrounding flow. Now, Prandtl's boundary layer here describes a momentum boundary layer where viscosity matters. But the same concept and principles can be applied to a variety of other types of systems. So I've written down here a slightly more general definition of what a boundary layer is. It's a transitional area between two distinct regions with different physical properties. And of course, in the Earth, there are many different things we call boundary layers. We have thermal boundary layers, compositional boundary layers, rheological boundary layers. I suspect Abby Kavner will talk about electrochemical boundary layers, so I've added this to the list. And maybe it's only a little bit ironic that the one type of boundary layer we don't have in the solid Earth is the one that Prandtl solved 100 years ago. There's no momentum boundary layer. here. And why do we care about boundary layers again? These are regions where properties are going to change dramatically. So this will create diversity in any feature that's associated with the presence of the boundary layer. And one example is the presence of a thermal boundary layer at Earth's surface that explains many of the features we associate with oceanic lithosphere. I think when Bruce Buffett goes through this analysis for thermal boundary layers, that's similar to what we just did, we will find, if you haven't seen it already, that the heat flow coming out of the oceanic lithosphere is going to scale inversely like the square root of the age of the oceanic plate. As rocks cool and contract, of course, they shrink. So simultaneously, you would predict the depth of the ocean basin scales like the square root of age. And in fact, to leading order, this is what you see when you look at the ocean basins, except for perhaps very old oceanic plates. And these two observations, in fact, played an important role, as you know, in testing the seafloor spreading hypothesis in the plate tectonics model. Okay. Now, in Prandtl's 1904 talk and 1905 paper, he introduced talked about one other additional process that originates in boundary layers, a process he called separation. Remember earlier I said that the outer flow simply provides the boundary conditions for what goes on inside that boundary layer. If the outer flow is such that there's an adverse pressure gradient at some location within the boundary layer, there may be locations in the boundary layer where the speed of the fluid falls to zero. If this happens, the boundary layer will detach or separate from the solid surface, and in this kind of case will send eddies and vortices out into the bulk of the fluid. So this is how our boundary layer can influence the surrounding region by separating from the boundary layer region and transmitting properties of that boundary layer into the surrounding fluid. To quote Prandtl once again, when dealing with a flow, the latter divides into two parts interacting with each other. On one side, we have the free fluid, which is dealt with as if it were frictionless. And on the other side, the transition layers near the solid wall. The motion of these layers is regulated by the free fluid, but they, for their part, give to the free motion its characteristic feature by the emission of vortex streaks. Now, again, in the solid Earth, we don't have momentum boundary layers, so we don't have eddies and vortices, but we have thermal boundary layers. And thermal boundary layers, if they become sufficiently buoyant to be gravitationally unstable, can detach from their source region. So this would be analogous to separation. And in the Earth, subduction of the cold oceanic lithosphere or the formation of mantle plumes would be analogous to the separation process, but for the case of thermal boundary layers. So there are two last points about boundary layers I wanted to end with, two complications that I think deserve to be highlighted right at the very beginning of all these presentations. And the first is that we have in the Earth multiple boundary layers that can overlap in space. And rather than last time I showed you a picture from Earth's surface, so this time we're going to go to the very base of the mantle, the boundary between the mantle and the core. And I picked a cartoon as an example here from Ed Garnero at Arizona State University. There are lots of things in this cartoon. We have a phase boundary right here shown with the dashed line between perovskite and a higher pressure phase post-perovskite. It's a phase boundary, so its location in space will depend on temperature and composition. The core is hotter than the mantle, so we're going to have thermal boundary layers at the base of the mantle. DTCP stands for dense thermochemical pile. This would be a layer hypothesized to be a layer that has a different composition. It's intrinsically more dense than the surrounding mantle, so it stays at the base of the mantle. It obviously has to interact with any thermal boundary layer at the base of the mantle. And the final acronym in this picture is ULVZ, which is hypothesized to be an area that may be partially molten. Whether or not you melt, of course, depends on composition and temperature. So here we have a cartoon illustrating a number of types of boundary layers that overlap in space, defined by composition, phase transitions, melting, temperature, presumably they're rheological variations. And each one of these boundary layers interacts with all the others. As an example, the simplest possible consequence of having overlapping boundary layers, I picked this example from Kumagai and others. What you're looking at here are the results of some lab experiments for detached thermal boundary layers. So again, analogous to the separation process that Prandtl talked about. Okay. And I think you've got snapshots of seven different experiments of thermal plumes. You're looking at a vertical cross-section through a tank of fluid. It's heated at the bottom. The parameter B at the top of each picture measures the relative importance of thermal buoyancy compared to compositional buoyancy. So the case on the left corresponds to a purely thermal plume. And on the right, the dense layer, this reddish stuff, has the greatest density. And you can see that at least for intermediate values of this buoyancy parameter relative densities, the plumes that rise have very complicated structures and very complicated time-dependent dynamics. The picture on the bottom simply shows the spatial distribution of the relative buoyancies. So the second and last complication I want to highlight is that not only do boundary layers overlap in space, but boundary layers that exist at one interface, for example Earth's surface, can interact with those at any other interface within the Earth, including the core mantle boundary. And as an example of this type of interaction, I picked some numerical simulations by McNamara at Arizona State University. Let me explain what you're looking at here. These are numerical simulations of mantle convection performed in a spherical shell. They've been unwrapped to a Cartesian geometry here, so it's a little bit easier to see what's going on. These simulations account for thermal convection, the history of plate motions as a boundary condition on Earth's surface. And that's actually what you see up here, map of Earth's surface. And they include in these simulations the presence of a dense layer that has a different composition at the base of the mantle, this reddish layer. And I think two things should jump out, or probably jump out right away when you look at these pictures. First, the location of this dense layer in space is obviously regulated and modulated by the presence of subduction. As these slabs sink to the base of the mantle around the Pacific here, they push the dense layer towards the middle of the Pacific. The panel on the bottom right shows the distribution of temperature in space. Red is hot and blue is cold. And you can see that the location of thermal plumes is modulated and governed by the shape of this dense layer and its location in space. So here there's an interaction between the thermal boundary layers at Earth's surface, the dynamics at the base of the mantle, and the interaction between compositional and thermal boundary layers. So a little bit more information if you want to go read something. A 50-year perspective, a 100-year perspective. Barry Gohl, a couple of years ago, wrote a very nice and readable History of Fluid Mechanics published by Oxford University Press. So to briefly summarize, the boundary layer concept states that most of the action occurs in thin layers, or confined to thin layers, and the rest of the domain simply provides the boundary conditions for the dynamics within that boundary layer. The boundary layer has virtually no influence on that surrounding region except when and where they detach from the boundary layer region to transmit information and properties of the boundary layer into the surrounding materials. In the Earth, we have many different types of boundary layers: thermal boundary layers, compositional boundary layers, rheological boundary layers. They interact with each other because they overlap in space. Boundary layers at one surface interact with those at any other interface. And I guess one of the goals and themes over the next coming weeks will be to understand how we characterize these different boundary layers and how we understand how they interact with each other. So I'm going to stop here, and Adam gets the remaining 40 minutes of this time slot. But I do have time, of course, to answer any questions.
Mike, did Prandtl understand the requirements of how boundary layers separate? Did he sort of have a pretty good grasp of what that was all about?
I think Prandtl probably, I haven't read his paper, but there are two parts. One was about separation, and he understood the concept that the outer flow governs the boundary conditions for the boundary layer region and can lead to separation. Oh, I meant to point out in passing, and I forgot, of course, that it took a long time for this boundary layer concept to really get well established. One of the classic fluid mechanics books is a book by Lamb called Hydrodynamics. The fifth edition, published in 1924, devoted just one paragraph to the concept. By 1932, the sixth edition, however, had a whole section and described the boundary layer equations. So Prandtl had a number of students who obviously didn't, whose influence didn't really extend all that far very quickly, Blasius in particular, and they did the same type of analysis for different types of geometries. They also did lab experiments, right, so they could compare their models with the lab experiments. Lord Rayleigh was interested in this topic too, and actually the analysis he performed in 1911 completely independently is similar to the thermal boundary layer you'll talk about. And Lord Rayleigh is famous for saying, you know, this is very nice, it has no relevance to reality, that if you look at the real world, you don't see these thin little boundary layers. They're simply too small. These boundary layers and the flows they were interested in become turbulent very quickly. So there's only a very special class of problems where actually this boundary layer analysis is directly relevant and applicable for moderate Reynolds numbers where you get these, the Karman vortex street detaching from the back, where this analysis could predict something quantitative. But it's still a useful concept, right? Mathematically, what you did is you took an elliptic set of equations and made them into parabolic equations. So they're so much easier to solve. And it led to the idea of matched asymptotic expansions, which became the basis for most 20th century boundary layer analysis. So it's the field took off, I guess, in the late 30s, and it's been applied to a number of different systems. Abby?
I have a question about interaction of different types of boundary layers. So, for example, the Carmental boundary, where you have different types of boundary layers that have different scales, you say that they interact with each other, but are there easy ways to simplify it by, you know, calling one of the boundary layers a master, like the temperature boundary layer, and then calling the other one a slave that only responds to that? Or do they, it seems, or do they all have to interact with each other in a nonlinear way?
Yeah, so Abby's raising an important question. When you have all these boundary layers that overlap, how do they actually interact? Is one passive and simply responds to the other or not? I think in that case that I showed you, the cartoon of Edgar Narrows, it's clear that overlapping compositional and thermal boundary layers really have a huge effect on each other. Rheological boundaries are a consequence of temperature primarily, so probably less so. It depends really on how big and how thick they are and the timescales over which their dynamics change.
So are the problems tractable?
I think so. There's certainly no shortage of literature on the interaction between compositional and thermal boundary layers, and nice analysis can be done on some of those types of problems. Yeah, right. In fact, it's always rude to go back through slides, right, because it's distracting. But, you know, you can predict when this dense layer is going to be able to rise, right? You'll be able to predict some of the dynamics that occur within this column because you have a column of dense fluid. So we have two overlapping boundary layers in space and time, and many aspects of this problem can be understood analytically and through scaling arguments too. I mean, lots of the details, of course, rely on numerical simulations. I cited Peter van Kaeken's paper down here, or, you know, lab experiments or whatever. But many of the aspects here can be understood qualitatively, certainly, and quantitatively, theoretically as well. So your electrochemical boundary layers, in fact, may be an example of something that's sort of largely independent of all those other types of boundary layers. Because they're thin, the timescales over which they develop and respond are so much shorter than all these other timescales. And that's an important question, actually. Yeah. Victor.
Is it clear in going forward that there will be some better unifying concept?
Than a boundary layer concept? It's hard to imagine, because what does a boundary layer do? We've got a set of equations, and each term has a different magnitude. And the boundary layer concept simply says, okay, we've got one term dominating one region, other terms in another region, and it formalizes how you deal with those interactions in scale. So I can't imagine how. But that could reflect a lack of imagination on my part, and that won't be the first time. Other questions? Abby?
Are there different rules for equilibrium and non-equilibrium boundary layers?
I don't know if there's such a concept of an equilibrium boundary layer. I mean, I guess boundary layers can reach a steady state, but then they're not really so interesting. And I'm not sure how you reach a steady state.
A boundary layer between two phases at equilibrium, the pressure and temperature is in equilibrium.
I see.
Like the top and bottom of the transition zone.
Yeah, but people don't usually think of those as being boundary layers. That the boundary layer concept really tells you how you adjust from one system to another system. So there's implicit in there variations, and in Prandtl's case, it was variations in space. The thermal boundary layer, it's in time. But because there's a flow, right, there's implicitly a time dependence that relates space and velocity and time. Yeah. I guess since we're overlapping actually with the dynamo session, as I close up my computer, I should point out that I've only focused on the mantle, right? But once you get to the core, there's a great richness of boundary layers, so much richer than the mantle. And I'm hoping Bruce Buffett will talk about this on Saturday morning, where the mathematics gets way more hairy, but you have interactions between rotation, inertia, viscous effects, magnetic effects, and as every time you add a new equation, you get a new balance, and so you get a new type of boundary layer. So a much richer type of boundary layer.
Is getting organized. I just forgot to mention that all of the talks are being taped and will be available on the web. And also, we will also post on the web all the PowerPoint presentations from the talks. So you don't need to be scrambling this process. You can take notes, but you don't have to worry about it.
We've also been having a meeting for the past 3 weeks. Sider continued 3 weeks into the past. And so all the talks and presentations, with a couple exceptions, are also online if you'd like to see those.
Yeah, no, that was the
There's no equations. That's why I was discouraging no equations.
Did you turn it on, Adam?
Turn on.
That's not a microphone. It doesn't amplify. It just records.
I know, but it still has to be on.
Did you turn it off? Or?
I didn't turn it off either.
Okay, so it should be on. There's a green light here.
Okay.
So, seismic tomography, I'm not quite sure why it shows. Brought a new element to considerations of the dynamic of the Earth's interior and geodynamic, geochemical, and mineral physics applications, because in addition to recognizing that there are these boundary layers, we can now look at what mark variations in temperature and composition actually leave on laterally varying properties of the Earth. So what I'm going to do is to discuss to some extent the seismic signatures of four different boundary layers. And these are, is that a laser? How does it work? Anybody? Well, anyway, there is a surface boundary layer. Okay, there is a surface boundary layer. There is a boundary between upper and lower mantle. There is a core mantle boundary layer. There is inner core, outer core boundary layer. And all of them have specific important signatures, and we'll briefly discuss some problems related to each of them. Now, this is a spectrum, power spectrum of lateral heterogeneity in the Earth as detected by shear velocity models from three different research groups. And you can see the very strong boundary layer at the surface. Of course, there's thermal, compositional, and rheological boundary layer. You can see that these strong colors end at a depth of about 200, 250 kilometers. Then you essentially have sort of a white, meaning more or less flat spectrum. Then you see a signature at 650 kilometers, and that's the boundary layer between upper and lower mantle. That red here is strong, blue is weak. So there is a strong signal here, and this is degree 2. Angular degree is essentially like a wave number, so the lower wave number, the larger the wavelength. So degree 2 is essentially something that has a wavelength of 20,000 kilometers at the surface. And then you see that at the bottom there is another increasing power, and again in degree two, and it's present in all models. It actually continues pretty much throughout the whole mantle, but with diminishing amplitude. So what we are going to do now, what a spectrum like this means is that a lot with lot of power contained in a relatively low degrees is that you can recover some very important features with relatively few coefficients. I don't know how many of you know about spherical harmonics, but it's the equivalent of Fourier transform on a sphere. So this is ocean function or continent ocean crustal thickness. And here it has a very characteristic spectrum. It's pretty flat for the first 5 degrees. Then it drops suddenly and begins to increase such that this slope is L, or harmonic order, to minus 2. So it's a very rapid decrease. What does it mean? Well, if we synthesize degrees only from 1 through A, the long wavelengths, we actually get a picture that shows us all major continents, and you would infer that indeed the continents and oceans tend to collect into a large scale bodies. What happens if you increase the number of coefficients? We are going now to degree 32, and that means that there's 15 times more coefficients. And you see somewhat more refined outlines of continents. You begin to recognize islands such as Madagascar, but for 15 times more information or data put in it, the basic information is already contained here. And this is very good, because if this was an inverse problem, that is, you try to recover these coefficients from some observations, you would have a very hard time obtaining these, because their amplitudes are small. It's actually even smaller than this looks. Actually, in terms of per harmonic, this would be L to the minus 3. So, but the good thing is that because there is so much power in these low degrees, you can obtain a meaningful picture with relatively few coefficients, which are relatively easy to retrieve. And so the power of global seismology, to some extent, depends on this ability. And as it turns out, if you remember the previous slide, that's actually what's happening. Okay, so current issues, these are examples. For example, anisotropy in the lithosphere asthenosphere system. So this is the top boundary layer. The transition zone and the fate of the subducted slabs, that's the, well, transition zone boundary layer. Then there's large structure. There's a lot of things that happen in lower mantle. I would just happen to talk about the large structures because they are well recovered by this limited degree tomography. And then brief mention of whether there are or aren't stable layers in the outer core, which has significant influence on how dynamo would work. So the surface boundary layer. Essentially, as far as the tomography goes, we are in pretty good shape. These are isotropic velocities, and there are three maps here, Harvard, Berkeley, and Caltech models. And if you look at it, they are extremely similar, even in small details, like, for example, this yellow spot sort of away from the ridge. Actually, in all these models, it was not said where the plate boundaries are. The computer is able to recover it from the seismic data, mostly surface waves and other types of data. And you can see a whole bunch of cratons, very fast, and mid-ocean ridges. and they look pretty much the same, and the amplitudes are the same. So in terms of isotropic properties, we are doing pretty good. But the sort of higher order property is anisotropy. And under flow, the crystal axes tend to align themselves. So this is one. The first row is the map view from above, and this is a cross section. So there is no particular ordering here. This would be the one of the axes, the important, like fast axis of the olivine crystal. There is no order, and the material will appear isotropic. That is the same properties in all directions. Here, you have ordering in a horizontal plane, but no ordering in azimuthal directions. Here you have both azimuthal and horizontal plane alignment. So these are different kinds of anisotropy. The anisotropy in general is very complex, but because of the difficulty with recovering, we essentially talk either about azimuthal anisotropy or radio anisotropy. The radio anisotropy is, remember, the one that crystals are arranged in a horizontal plane, but not necessarily in the azimuth. This is an example of phase velocities, radio wave phase velocities at 60 second period. And the colored contoured thing is the isotropic phase velocities part that's the same in all directions. And the red lines show by both length and the direction of the fast axis. And you can see that here on East Pacific Rise, they are pretty much perpendicular to the ridge. And this has been known for some 35 years. When the plate reaches some 100 or so age of the plate, million years, this seems to disappear. So this part of the Pacific, for example, doesn't show much of the anisotropy. And it can be either that anisotropy vanishes or that there are different behaviors of anisotropy at different depths. And there are some results that indicate that the latter is the case. A very detailed study was done by Marone and Romanovic just last year. And this shows the alignments of fast axis at three different depths, 100 kilometers, 200, and 300. And as you can see, the patterns change appreciably. What you see at the surface is essentially superposition of the effect of all three layers. So it's not very clear what you would see. But in the next picture, if you calculate synthetic travel times for the wave, shear wave split by the anisotropy, you essentially find that at the depth, that this layer at the depth of 300 kilometers is what allows you to align the fast direction of the observed travel times with the predictions of the model. And here you can see this is the same thing, but zoomed on this area. So there are beginnings of trying to recover anisotropy. It's still somewhat, it's much more fragile parameter than isotropic velocities, and to some extent there are important opportunities to find out the directions, for example, anisotropy, because it's associated with flow, can tell us about previous plate motions or their relative motion with respect to the asthenosphere. This is, now we are going to the radio anisotropy, where waves propagating horizontally move with a different velocity than the waves propagating vertically. And here is Pacific again, and these are isotropic variations, so you have this strong East Pacific rise with some extensions at this point, and this is super swell, so that sort of indicates that this is thermal. But what you see generally is that the velocities, as plate cools, velocities increase. On the other hand, the anisotropic variations, which is a difference between shear velocity in this particular case in a vertical direction and horizontal direction, does not bear any relationship to the plate tectonics or aging of the plate. The maximum or minimum, actually, the strongest, the lowest SV velocities are in the middle of the plate. So it has to be some other complexity not foreseen by plate tectonics. And the answers are not clear yet at this time, but it probably this particular thing has to do with the injection of some additional material from below. So it should have some perhaps significant geochemical signatures. This is cross-section along this line from Chile to Japan, more or less coinciding with the direction of the plate motion. This is the isotropic image. You can see the velocities under East Pacific rise are anomalous to a depth of some 200 kilometers. And then they, near the surface, increase with the increasing age. But this increase actually does not stop at 100 kilometers as some thermal models would show, but actually goes significantly deeper. This is this anisotropic layer, and the maximum is, as previous slide showed, more or less in the middle of the Pacific. It seems to, its depth seems to sort of descend as the plane ages. I'm not quite sure whether this is a resolvable issue or not, but it's a very strong layer with a similar range of variations as that of isotropic velocities. So it's probably, it's very important to understand how this comes about. The anisotropy under continents and oceans is different. Things happen under oceans at smaller depth, so that the so-called Gutenberg layer is at about 80 kilometers, and after that you have strong anisotropy with SH horizontally propagating shear waves greater than SV. Under continents you have it at greater depth, perhaps 200 or 250 kilometers, and then you again have SH greater than SV. So now we go to transition zone. That's, transition zone has been a, or what happens there and what does not happen, has been a strong, has been a subject of argument for at least 40 years and maybe longer. And it has to do with the fact whether the, you have so-called whole mantle convection or layered convection. Of course, the, it turns out that these extremes, the two N members, neither of them is probably valid. But there is signature here that there is a strong heterogeneity, particularly in degree two, in a transition zone, and does not continue into the lower mantle. And you see pretty much the same thing in the other two models from Caltech and Berkeley. So what does it mean? Well, this is the same picture in space domain. So here we have a map of seismic velocity anomalies at 600 kilometers. You can see they are again very similar. And this is at 800 kilometer depth on the other side of the 650 kilometer discontinuity. And here are the spectra at 600 in these three models. And what you see, there is enormous difference in a strength, particularly a degree two, and generally perhaps even other degrees. And after that, the spectrum becomes white, and it's pretty much white also at 800 kilometers. So you see the same thing in all three models, and it must represent the fact that the 650 kilometer discontinuity impedes somehow the flow in the mantle. To what extent, that's sort of still open question. There are some cross sections through relatively recent model. It shows, this is A is one of the Isobonin, I guess, transition layer. Here are the earthquakes, deep earthquakes, and this is the widened anomaly underneath it. B is through, I guess, Formosa, I guess, close to this. Again, deep earthquakes. And then you have somewhere more than 20 degrees of this fast anomaly. And actually, if you look, the anomaly is actually concentrated near the bottom of the transition zone. This is 400 kilometers, this is 650. And the boundary is actually depressed, being characteristic of, well, either deeper phase change or essentially the negative buoyancy of this material. And this is the cross-section through Indonesia, north-south. And again, you see the same thing, very fast anomaly, but then again, fast anomaly and very little below. So there's no indication that these slabs penetrate immediately to the lower mantle. There's some additional evidence, for example, from seismicity, where here for Tonga Kermadec region, it's actually this red box, the yellow box is a mistake. I wanted to make it stronger, but then I moved the picture and didn't move with the picture. So you essentially have a sort of traditional thing here where predominantly compression axis align with the Benioff zone. But once you go to a depth of about 550 kilometers, things change. This dip shallows. And also you have a whole family of earthquakes that have essentially a perpendicular direction of axis. So what this may represent is the interaction of the slab with 650 kilometer discontinuity and reorientation of stresses, perhaps breaking up of the slab. Interesting other example is Isobonin, where you have this earthquake that's 200 kilometers away from all the other earthquakes. But what you see here is that at the depth of about 500 kilometers, the orientation of stress axis changes. And this earthquake actually is only at the depth of about 550 kilometers. So that may essentially mean that the transition zone in this region is already full of slabs, and this is a slab which sort of gets piled on the top of it. The purpose of this slide is not to criticize the paper by Grant at all. It is to call your attention to the fact that this slide, which became sort of a poster child for whole mantle convection, actually, even if the velocities are such as shown here, it's not a global picture. It's not really representative of the system as whole. There is some indication, and we can see it in Grant's model, there's another high velocity structure somewhere here, and this is not resolved by these data sets, but it is resolved by other models that have a better data coverage. It doesn't mean that there is no communication between upper and lower mantle. These three red circles, circle areas where there is a subduction zone, there is a fast anomaly in the within the transition zone, but there's also fast anomaly underneath. So in these three cases, you could have limited penetration of the slab material. But what is important to remember that only part of this flux gets to the lower mantle. And I was very encouraged by talk that Sudhir Mukhopadhyay gave here last Friday. He will be back towards the end of this week, and he may have an opportunity to tell you the same story. But there's sort of a geochemical model which is capable of separating upper and lower mantle such that concentrations of certain geochemical series is possible and develops with time. So that would be quite consistent with the fact that not all the slab material penetrates into the mantle, lower mantle, and that much of it is recirculated in the upper mantle. So there's a number of questions that arise with respect to the transition zone. The 410 kilometer discontinuity in terms of topography appears to be completely decorrelated from the 650 kilometers. So this image where you have a whole very wide mantle flow where 400 in cold regions, 410 kilometer discontinuity is elevated and 650 depressed, really does not apply to a large scale topography. How do these slabs interact with 650 kilometers? What happens to this material after it stagnates in the transition zone? And why is this abrupt change in the spectral power across this discontinuity? So now we go to the core mantle boundary layer. There's a lot of problems there, but we'll concentrate on these global ones. This is another, again, a power spectrum indicates this very strong anomaly at the bottom. This is the RMS, very large at the surface. It drops suddenly across the 650 kilometers, continue, reaches minimum at about 1600 kilometers, then begins to increase gradually and more rapidly at the bottom of the mantle. But you can see it's a very gentle increase. So we again zoom in for these three models, and essentially in a typical Caltech model, this degree two continues way up. If we look at the maps of the shear velocity anomalies some 90 kilometers above core mantle boundary, they are not identical. They are not as identical as those at 100 kilometers, but they all show this very distinct pattern where you have a slow anomaly in the middle of the Pacific, slow anomaly under Africa. Here it's split, so you have to mentally put these two ends together. And the ring of fast velocities around the Pacific. Here the spectral content and the details vary, but this big picture is pretty much the same in all. This degree two anomaly has been recognized as early in 1984, and this is equatorial cross-section. Here you see this Pacific anomaly, very big thing, the African anomaly, very big thing, and essentially two cold regions in between, one associated with the Indian Ocean, and the other one, somewhat more complex, associated with crossover of some Americas. Now, if you try to map these things in three dimensions, and I picked somewhat at random two models, Scripps and Caltech, this is view from above. It's the red isosurface, negative isosurface, minus 0.6% anomaly. The blue is plus 0.6 anomaly. And you can see these huge structures that it's truncated at 800 kilometers depth because upper mantle would be very complicated. Here you can see it from the core view, and you can see that these are this enormous vertical exaggeration, of course, here. This is 40,000 kilometers, that's only three, that they are pretty continuous features throughout the mantle, lower mantle. This is a picture. One thing that you cannot get with this very red tomography, you cannot get sharp boundaries, because the sharp boundaries essentially have to be represented by very high spherical harmonics. There's a lot of them, but they are in phase. So one thing that we couldn't tell from the pictures that I showed before is how sharp this boundary is. And this follows a number of studies where they used a different type of data, and they demonstrated that essentially the edge of the African anomaly is fairly steep, so that it's pretty flat along at least something like 1,000 kilometers, maybe more. Here, I guess you have it probably 3,000 kilometers in this view. So this leads to speculation that these are distinct things, so that it's not essentially some diffusive boundary between cold and hot, but it may be a chemical boundary. And in trying to understand the origin of these, what we call, some people call it pyos, we call it superplumes or megaplumes, and we thought that by finding the P and S velocity models, that somehow this question, what these things are, may be answered. And the separation of the variables into bulk sound velocity and shear velocity was actually successful in doing this. So we derived the 3D perturbations of bulk sound velocity and shear velocity. The bulk sound velocity is square root of k, where k is bulk modulus over rho. So it separates, and shear velocity, of course, is square root of mu over rho. So mu and k are separated in these expressions, while in p velocity, both of them enter into definition of p velocity. So when our upper mantle model showed that essentially the bulk sound velocity Vc is correlated positively with shear velocities. Here you see all these slabs again. But if we go into lower mantle, the picture changes. And actually here in the Pacific, you have strong anti-correlation. This is red, this is blue. This tends to be blue here, but is red in shear velocity. So mineral physicists tell us it's very difficult to obtain anti-correlation between shear and bulk modulus without introducing compositional changes. There is actually some indication that, for example, under Asia, this strong positive velocity anomaly, actually the bulk sound velocity is actually positively correlated here with shear velocity. So that would be a further argument in favor of chemical variations. This is correlation between these two maps as a function of depth, and you can see that from some 2,000 kilometers or even 1,800 on, the correlation coefficient is on the order of minus 0.8, which is a very high correlation. It's actually quite positive, up to 0.7 in the upper mantle. So clearly, this is a property that changes with depth, and that may still, again, point towards the chemical distinction of these fast anomalies. So how are the superplumes formed? This is a question for really geodynamicists, to some extent mineral physicists, and well, it has implication for geochemistry. What part of the anomaly is caused by compositional rather than thermal variations? Because thermal variations also cannot be ruled out. And why do superplumes continue above V double prime without an apparent abrupt change? It essentially says that V double prime in this case is not a boundary for these superplumes, that they are strong in the last 200 kilometers above the core, but they continue with somewhat diminishing amplitude all the way to perhaps transition zone. Now, outer core boundary layers, that's mostly implications for geodynamo and also people trying to understand composition of the core. So generally, outer core is expected to be well mixed. So, however, in some 3D models, compressional velocity shows the gradients at the top and the bottom of the core are anomalous. That is not consistent with homogeneous material, which this property can be studied by looking at something that's called Boolean factor, and it's one for homogeneous material. If it deviates significantly from one, significantly in sort of statistical sense, that means that there is some radial heterogeneity. So there is some feeling that perhaps both of these layers are stable. This is an example of two models which are often used as reference models. There is PREM, which actually was forced to be homogeneous in terms of the Boolean factor. So if you look in the tables, the Boolean factor is extremely close to 1, maybe like 0.99 to 1.01. On the other hand, the other often used model is AK135, and you can see that their gradients differ. The AK135 has a fairly steep gradient, which would not be consistent with homogeneity. Actually, this would be strange because this would imply a heavier material at the top of the core, which would not really be stable. And then there are small differences at the bottom, and I'm going to show these in more detail. Most of them become flatter than PREM. This is PREM, and this is four other studies, and all of them show a flatter. However, the spread is still fairly significant. This is the newest paper, 2005, and it has a gradient that's significantly larger, for example, than Suriot and Poupinet. So there is still some debate, however, there are, as you may be able to hear later, some indications that indeed this gradient is shallower than in PREM, and therefore that the bottom of the outer core may be enriched in light materials. So there's a number of core questions, outer core questions. Are there stable layers at the top and bottom of the outer core? There is some evidence now, there is a recent unpublished yet paper which shows that essentially gradient of velocity is such as in PREM, which would remove the at least possibility of a large stable layer at the top. How large is the density contrast between the inner and outer core? How the properties of the inner core vary with depth? And what is the cause of inner core anisotropy? We did not talk about it. So to finish, let me show you that maybe there is one more boundary layer. It's about 6 years old, still tentative. Some people agree that there is something in the last 300 or 400 kilometers of the inner core, and it's been called innermost inner core. So maybe there is one more boundary layer inside the Earth. So that's the talk. Thank you for listening without interruptions. Maybe some questions. Yes.
So Michael showed this model in his last talk on, I think, Narayan Shiji Zong, that the upwellings from the lower mantle are highly influenced by subduction, or the slabs going down all the way to the bottom. And so you have a lot of the slabs, you know, kind of frustrated at the transition zone, the heat transition zone. So how does that impact the cooling of the lower mantle, in particular cooling of the core, and ultimately the rise of plumes from the bottom?
Well, it's several questions, I guess. Seismology can give you only a snapshot in time. It does not tell you anything about what happens, what happened either before or what will happen next. For that, you need geodynamics, a model that at least at the present time would be consistent with the snapshot. But then from that model, you would see what happened before and what's likely to happen next. My personal feeling, and again, you cannot get it from seismology, is that this material accumulates in a transition, the slab material accumulates in, you know, maybe partly reabsorbed in the upper mantle. But then at some point where it begins to drip into the lower mantle, these are not avalanches as massive as those that, for example, Tuckley or some other people that did avalanche models envisioned in the past. It's more a drip than a big flashing event. In one area, that is the Tonga-Fiji area, there was a relatively, well, five-year-old paper by Pisklevitz and all who actually proposed that you have an avalanche going on in that region, sort of between Vanuatu Islands and Tonga, Kermadec. So they actually modeled it as if it were what happens if slab there broke through, and it actually is consistent with the plate motions in that particular area. So what I think happens, but again, I cannot really tell it from seismology alone, is that there are avalanches and much of the slab material eventually gets into the lower mantle, because it's difficult to imagine what would cause this ring of fast velocities around the Pacific, although you have to remember that this represents deviations from average. So if we knew what's the proper average for the Earth, you know, these, I mean, you could lift the average in some way such that, for example, the regions that now look black would be totally neutral and the super plumes would be stronger. So there is a space for, you know, so it's a blue color, should not really be overemphasized, because, as I say, these things are relative. Let's see, anything else? And this modeling. Well, one of the modeling that Alan McNamara showed had to do with super plumes, or groups of plumes, really. I think that in that case, it sort of prefers these very large red areas, essentially a bunch of small plumes that appear red in these low resolution seismic images. But the fact that the edge of it is straight essentially would indicate that these are really large sized bodies. So it would be difficult to obtain it by the subduction alone and just stuff being pushed away. Also, I guess in that case, it would need to be chemically distinct, just colder. But because there is evidence that it's chemically distinct, you know, these things might have existed from the beginning of the formation. It's not clear how mobile they are because they are so large. So actually, maybe one of the things that sort of anchored there at the Core-Mantle boundary and plate tectonics and everything else works around it. I mean, it's a wild statement which cannot be derived from seismology alone. So I hope that I have showed you how seismic tomography as a tool allows us to address in greater detail and bring up new questions, I guess. For example, 25 years ago, nobody thought that there are super plumes, that the bottom of the mantle looks so simple. There is a lot of details that change very rapidly. People did not have an idea. So for example, they would study very small areas and thought that they are representative of Core-Mantle boundary as a whole. But that's not true. This huge image really prevails. And you see it, what makes it convincing also is that you see it in data. It's not only after you threw a lot of numbers into computer worked for some time and something came out. If you actually can see it in the data that you put in the version, then you get the same thing back more or less. Yes?
Adam, I wonder if there's alternatives to the idea that slabs are getting hung up by transition zones. And I guess what I was wondering was, when you go through these transition zones, you get new crystals and you would have big changes in grain size. And I guess what I was wondering is, could you actually have sort of a change in grain size, maybe masking?
Well, it sort of would be difficult to, I mean, I cannot say no. I my knowledge of mineral physics and, you know, effects of the grain size, but I don't quite see that it would, well, for one thing, what you see is that these fast anomalies continue for a very long distance from the place that they're being subducted. So the image of the in the upper mantle or transition zone itself is telling that these things don't go straight through. But then it would be difficult to think that, you know, the transition or the effect of the phase transformation would be such that you would not see, because even the phase transformation, I guess, would not change the relative, if these effects are thermal, would not change the relative perturbation temperature. So you should right. still see maybe very broad, but also fast or blue.
Well, I guess what I was thinking is small grains. I don't know whether the sign actually works, but you might think that small grains would also have slow velocities, and so the slow velocity of the grain size could partially counteract
some
thermal
experts so here.
I don't even know whether the sign works, but I just sort of toss that out as a
mineral physics.
But just a comment about the seismology, and you know, you've got to remember that we wouldn't be able to see the slabs above the 660 unless they were broadened. We don't see them up shallow, so for sure they're getting squished out.
Yeah.
And that's the only way we can image them with this kind of data.
Yeah, the width is sort of beyond the question.
Right.
You know, question is what happens afterwards.
Right.
I mean, sometimes people talk, especially in case of retreating trenches, that slab essentially gets laid down, but when there is enough of it, it sinks into the lower mantle. And well, that's not very different from the avalanche model, but even in areas where the trench doesn't seem to be retreating, we do see some widening of anomalies in the transition zone, positive anomalies. There was a hand there.
I was just going to point out that I think that most individual grains, you know, whether they're large grains or small grains, are still small compared to the
But I think the point is that when you have a material made up of a bunch of small grains, I think it tends to be a little bit weaker than a material made out of the same material but with bigger grains. I think there is a grain size dependence in these velocities. I don't know whether it's big enough to do this, but I think there is a grain size dependence independent of thermal effects and independent of composition.
So would you expect the grains in the lower mantle to be smaller or larger?
Just because you've gone through a new phase, so you've nucleated new phases, and they have to grow with time. And so there is a grain size dependence. And I guess my real question is, if people looked at that as an issue, and do we know very much about it, and could it play a role in this?
Well, it's been looked at from a rheological point of view, right?
Yeah.
By Salamatov, and I don't unless physical dispersion is really strong for a situation like that, I can't see how it can affect the seismic velocities. I have a comment.
Yeah, I would hope that you would. Because otherwise it would mean that you completely disagree with everything you said and it's not worth talking about it.
I've been looking at this anti-correlation of the both sound speed and shear velocity in the lower mantle and just trying to nail down the depth extent. In your 1997 model, you basically have the whole of the lower mantle being anti-correlated between both sound speed and shear velocity, which means something strange is going on through all the lower mantle. But it turns out actually that you can get quite a strong trade-off between the way that you handle earthquake locations and bulk sound speed in the mid-mantle. And you can change the bulk sound speed model quite a lot because of that trade-off, depending exactly on how you deal with the earthquakes. And if we do iterative location type things such as you did, then we come out with the same strong anti-correlations, but that if you do earthquake locations differently, then you come out with a positive correlation between bulk sound and the shear velocity everywhere except for perhaps the bottom 600 or 700 kilometers. And then it only gets really strong right down at the bottom. I mean, nobody's arguing that there isn't a strong anticorrelation of bulk sound speed and shear velocity right at the bottom. But the question is, does it really extend all the way through? Or,
well, the picture that I showed, I guess, is sort of does imply that it's changing and that it assumes. I mean, this model was designed to be continuous, I guess. So, indeed, the RMS velocities in the middle are weak, so there is a lot of noise.
Yeah, you can actually get a fairly reasonable positive correlation all the way down to down to about 2,000 kilometers. And then it starts.
Yeah.
Then it starts to drop strongly negative.
So, the middle mantle, I guess, is a place where I didn't show examples, but I guess the correlation among various models is probably the weakest because the amplitude is small.
But
I agree that relocations of earthquakes is important, but many of the data, it doesn't even work with sort of differential travel times because these are less sensitive to the earthquake location.
Yeah, I mean, we made these models with all the data. I mean, of course, they're dominated by the P and the S data sets, which are a few hundred thousand parts. And they're the things which dominantly control the earthquake locations.
Yeah, in this model, essentially P wave data, and the way you do it is more consistent because the P wave data, your P wave data are of the same nature. I mean, they're sort of taken from the waveforms. The P wave data here were from ISC bulletins and S wave data were read from waveforms.
Yeah, this is kind of a technical point. I just would like the general audience to know that in seismology, some odd things can happen, like these structures can be a little bit sensitive to the way you handle earthquake locations, right? So you have to be aware that we can change the details of these models depending on how we do the inverse problem. I think Adam would agree with that.
Yeah, I completely agree. Some of these things are quite fragile, I guess, when, like anisotropy, I think that to some extent we know that it's there, we can see very clearly it's, but for example, detailed depth distribution is still very tentative. And different models differ other than spatially, that is in terms of the location and the sign of the anomaly, there's agreement, but for example, there's still some disagreement in the detailed depth distribution of anisotropy.
So I have a comment or question about that. About the top boundary layer. You emphasize this specific anomaly where SH is much faster than SV.
Uh-huh.
But in fact, I mean, isn't that consistent with that being in the astenosphere? With an astenospheric layer? In fact, if you look at, there are some studies by a group in Colorado of azimuthal anisotropy, and they show very clearly the change in azimuthal anisotropy when you go from the lithosphere to the astenosphere. I guess roughly, because this is surface waves, so the depth resolution isn't very good, but you can see that below about 100 kilometers, the anisotropy is not only SH faster than SV, but it's also the direction of the azimuth, so of the path velocity is parallel to the absolute plate motion. So all of this would be, it seems to me consistent with the idea that that you're in the asthenosphere, you're looking at the asthenosphere.
Yeah, but it is a stenospheric effect. And however, so you see it continuously throughout the Pacific plate. But the level, the maximum of it, is in the center, and sort of it diminishes on both. So there is no clear age progression of this. It's actually strongest in the middle. So I'm not sure. On the other hand, in a simple sort of, these are just phase velocities and isotropy in terms of inverting the phase velocity measurements for both isotropic and anisotropic parts, that right here in a, let's see, Hawaii is here someplace, so a little bit farther west, but this 2 theta anisotropy vanishes. Of course, it could be
shallow, because you're at 60 seconds, so you're influenced.
Well, it sort of goes down to 100 seconds, 100 kilometers or so.
Well, it has signature both from the lithosphere
and the sphere. Well, it's sort of, I don't have that slide, but it's also the same thing happens at 100 kilometers. At 100 seconds. So if there was this additional pulse, or, you know, which people talk that there was some pulse, and that this is why the 100 kilometer thick cooling plate models are incorrect, because there has been a heat pulse some 70 million years ago, and it reheated the lithosphere, and this is why people think, just looking at bathymetry data, that you cannot have plate thicker than 100 kilometers, that it's effect of reheating the events that happen somewhere in the middle of the plate. And oh, I can see what weather in my hometown is. Is that because I guess somehow the thing started working? Let's cancel it. Obviously this picture at, you know, intermediate period, not very short, like 35 seconds, not very long, like 150 seconds, it's not unique answer that you could have. Essentially, anisotropies, azimuthal velocity anisotropies, somewhere here, that would vary with depth and essentially cancel out at the surface. But I said it already a couple of times that, my understanding is that, or experience is that, the anisotropy tends to be tricky, and we have gotten different answers even among the Harvard studies, so it's not institutional. Yes?
Adam, what's the most compelling evidence for stratification of the outer core?
Stratification of the outer core. I think that at this time what I would say is that the stratification at the bottom of the core is probably better documented than that at the top. Top of the core is sort of difficult place to study, because it represents a huge low velocity zone to P waves. So you have to retrieve it, you have to depend on SKS and multiple KS phases, and they are not particularly easy to read. And so from P waves, you essentially, the first ray that bottoms is at a depth of about 1,000 kilometers below the Kármán-Tu boundary. So you have to use these SKS data. And it's only recently that, and it's unpublished paper yet, that somebody was able to measure differential travel times between S4KS, for example, and SKKS, and that gives very strong constraints on velocity at the top of the core, which, for example, I don't know exactly what it was that Kenneth and Anglo have used in derivation of their AK135 model, but that, so anyway, the person that got all these SMK phases, travel times, essentially their best model agrees extremely closely with Prem, which assumption there was that the core is homogeneous. So at the top of the core, I would say that the evidence now is very weak, but at the bottom of the core, well, Prem sort of is outlier. All the models, five of them, show that the velocity gradient is shallower. However, there is still fairly large discrepancy between different models. And maybe Guy will comment on what it might mean.
I'm, if Dave Govins actually shows up, I mean, he wrote a paper in which I did the seismological stuff, trying to explain the boundary layer at the base of the outer core in terms of a mixed phase region between the inner core and the outer core. I mean, you have to have something strange there just to be able to get heat out of the inner core and grow the inner core. And so Bruce may have some insight into this too. So I don't think it's necessarily unexpected that you would have strange velocity gradients down at the bottom. As far as the top stuff is concerned, you can have stuff going on in a thin layer near the top. I don't think we can say anything about that, but the free oscillation frequencies are very unhappy with an AK135 type outer core velocity distribution. You have to have something much more Prem-like. So I think there's a lot of evidence to show that the bulk of the outer core looks quite mutually stable.
So Dave said you would explain the bottom boundary layer to us. He gave his talk and he blamed you, I think, for the seismology.
Well, he and Francis did the modeling of the phase diagram and so on, and I just checked their models against the seismology. So that's all I'm to blame for.
Yeah, I guess comment on comment is that Prem was built using jointly very large data set of normal mode frequencies and travel times. On the other hand, AK135 was built using only travel times, and then as afterthought there is some accompanying density model, which is actually pretty bad because it was assumed that P and S velocities are perfect and that everything that differs has to be relegated to density variations. So, and the important thing is in reading tomographic papers is also to check what data people have used. Because, for example, if somebody used only teleseismic that sort of passed 25 degree travel times, which bottom in a lower mantle, these people don't really have much of a business to telling you what the upper mantle looks like. And there is a lot of it going on. So hopefully the participants of this CIDR event will avoid that mistake, making that mistake.
Yeah. Just to add a couple more comments to this general discussion is I would say you have to probably, Guy, get rid of heat and probably composition from the inner core boundary, I think, because we believe that that's important for the present data. And for the layer at the top, one of the things that you have to make sure is that we see features in the magnetic field, which represent vertical motion, bringing field up, new sort of flux patches of observing at the core mantle boundary. And one of the things that you find is that a layer at the top gets too thick, you start to not see those features. And so, consistent with what Guy was saying, we can't have a layer which is too thick, which would sort of inhibit or filter, essentially, some of the features that we observe in the historical changes in the magnetic field. I don't recall the numbers off top, but I think it's anything more than 100 kilometers is probably out of bounds.
Certainly 100 kilometers. Actually, you know, if it was 20, you could get away with it. I don't know how deep these S4KS phases bottom in the outer core. But in addition to these, there is a complete S infinity KS expansion, the Bayer expansion. And they essentially occur as a pulse. But it should be possible to model this pulse, for example, using normal modes and see, you know, these later things, if there is any indication in it that there is a faster layer, actually. As I say, this paper I'm talking about is really first step in this direction, but it did not go beyond S4KS, and it should be possible to use the complete expansion, that is to model a pulse which will just consist from, you know, S, KKS from 4 or 5 to infinity. And that would really capture the top of the core velocity. So it's possible to do. Somebody needs to do that. Well, I guess we hit our time limit. Everybody was very much on time.
We will have our coffee break here outside the auditorium, and we can go also out to